Yes, sir.
But my memory would be that in considerable part it was Mr. Dulles's and his policies that made him believe that the Central Pact would help in the stabilization of the Middle East and Southeast Asia area. Now, another comment on this, Secretary Dulles, this isn't necessarily applicable to this particular circumstance, but often the press or the media that I don't mean to restrict it to them because I think it's in academia or just the general public, look at Mr. Dulles as a very not narrow-minded, but very set in his ways and definite views. I found him quite the opposite. As I say, I often traveled with him. At that time, he traveled in a four-engine airplane propeller driven, so it had about 10 bursts in it. So he would limit the party to 10 people, including two security guards. I mention that because today they take innumerable civil service, secret service. Then there were only two State Department guards. No secret service. Mrs. Dulles would go with him, his secretary. Perhaps the counselors of the State Department, sometimes the legal advisor, sometimes the assistant secretary, and the desk officer of the areas concerned, and then one representative from defense, which in those days happened to be me, the VR. He would, if he were writing a speech, he would make a draft of it. He would pass it around to all of the people with him, saying, give me any thoughts you have, changes or additions. And I was impressed that he would listen. And say the desk officer would say, well, Mr. Dulles, I don't think you should say that because of these reasons. I think you ought to add this in because of these reasons. Mr. Dulles would listen and say, well, and he might argue the point, be in exchange, and he said, all right, I'll put it in. Or he said, no, I disagree with you, I'll just leave it out. He had an open mind. Now that didn't mean when he made up his mind finally after considering all the points he thought. But he didn't stick to it, he did, unless he saw some reason to change. But he did not have the narrowness of view or the unchangeability that is often he still reflects about it, at least in my limited experience with it.
Well, he certainly treated as being sort of an inflexible person. That's the popular.
I thought he had a flexible mind, yeah. Willing to explore all aspects of the problem. Then when he made up his mind, he did remain inflexible in the sense that he didn't see any point to change that unless somebody gave him a really good reason, and then I think he would considered that, and if it modified his view, he would have changed. I came away with a feeling he was a very fine Secretary of State. And he did keep Eisenhower fully informed, and Eisenhower would be in touch with him. So people would say, well, Mr. the President doesn't really know what's going on. And he did. And even if he hadn't taken an interest, which he did, the secretary would have always gone back to him.
In terms of Dulles's interest in the Baghdad Pact, I guess the U.S. never became a formal member of the pact.
Yes,
it was just the British and the countries in the region. But apparently the U.S. still participated in the military planning of the pact. Did the ISA have to coordinate that military planning, or have to do with the military planning, or would it be someone else in the Pentagon that would actually do the war planning and so forth?
Well, any actual planning would have been done by that area that was the one involved. If we were really talking about military planning, it wouldn't have been ISA. It would have been Joint Chiefs or a particular service and their aspect of it. But ISA would have been in touch with what was going on and would have participated in any way that was valid for it to participate. And obviously wouldn't try to say what strategic or tactical military plan should be. It might have a comment on it, but that wasn't an area of expertise of ISA or state for that matter. You might have ideas on it. It was too important to be left to the generals, sort of, but as for the Pacific, I think you go to the military.
I see. Did you stay at the State Department? Were you at the Defense Department until the end of the administration, until the end of Eisenhower? Did you participate in transition talks with the Kennedy administration officials?
Yes, to a degree. I talked with both Mr. McNamara and Mr. Nitze, Mr. Nitze being my immediate successor, and some of his people. And I've always had a higher regard and respect for Mr. Nitze. This has only grown over the years, and I'm happy he's in the position he is in today. And he's an able, dedicated man.
Did you have any more? Did you do any further government work during the 60s? You went back to your law practice, apparently.
Right, but I came back to New York. I loved working in Washington, and I always have, but once my job is over, I was quite happy to come back to New York. I never had a desire to hang on in Washington. But I did negotiate with Panama about a canal treaty under Johnson, which ultimately came to fruition at a much later date. And then in the late, well, in 1969, early, I negotiated in Peru under President Nixon. Peru had nationalized the International Petroleum Company, which was a Canadian company with a subsidiary of Exxon. So I was asked to go down. I was practicing law in New York at that time, and I asked to go down to negotiate with the new Peruvian military government that had just seized power. So the rest of my 60s.
Did William Rogers ask you to do that?
No. Well, indirectly, I suppose. The person who talked to me was Elliot Richardson.
He's a State Department man.
He was Undersecretary. Undersecretary, later title was changed to Deputy Secretary. That was actually when I was there. I was an Undersecretary one day and Deputy Secretary the next. And I was the only one who spoke against changing the title. It seemed to be the fashion in Washington those days. There was a Deputy Secretary of Defense, and then everybody else thought, well, we ought to have a Deputy Secretary instead of an Undersecretary. For many years, the state had the Undersecretary, who was the number two, and also had an Undersecretary for Political Affairs, or an Undersecretary for Economic Affairs. It was the Undersecretary, who later became the Deputy Secretary. Purely a matter of title. No real significance at all.
In terms of the Peruvian question that you helped negotiate, without going into the details, did the government, the U.S. government, consider invoking the Hickam Amendment at any point during the negotiations that were the nationalization of these properties?
There was consideration of it, but I think I don't know how serious it ever really was. I recommended against it, although it certainly was one of the uses. It was a negotiating tool, not in the sense that you used it as a threat, but they knew that was in the background.
They called it foreign aid. Did the oil companies involved see it that way? Did they?
I never talked to the oil companies.
Oh.
And in any major way, I talked to one of their representatives, but they really didn't have much day-to-day or any real participation. And in fact, all I did really was keep the subject open. The new military government, in my memory may not be accurate, they came in power one day, and the immediate reaction in the country was unfavorable. And almost the very next day, maybe 2 days at most, they confiscated IPC. And that was a popular move. And it really made them popular and gave them a base to work on popularity, which they hadn't had in the first 24 hours. This is what I remember. And when I went down to negotiate shortly thereafter, it was clear that the government was not going to take any remedial action with respect to IPC. We had talks going on for 6 months or so, or even longer, but quite concentrated for the first few months. But what it did do was keep it open to such a time where later on it was settled to each the United States and the Peruvian government reaching a settlement, but each interpreting it in different ways. The United States, in effect, interpreted it as remuneration and settlement of the IPC case. The Peruvian government, they had nothing to do with IPC. This was another matter that they were settling with the United States. So they gave each an out. The U.S. didn't need an out. It was really just handling it in such a way as it didn't cause the government of Peru to feel like backing down on what had been one of their first acts.
Hmm. And this is the IPC, the International Petroleum Corporation, is that?
That's not the name of it.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Now, what were the circumstances that led to your appointment as Under Secretary of State? Was it privy negotiations or?
That I don't know. I was telephoned one day by Mr. Rogers and said, would I come down and see him? And this is in 1970, mid-1970. Well, but one never really knows what leads to these things. In fact, I've noticed in government there'll often be a group of people on a list, not on a list per se, I don't mean that. Nobody has a list of potential candidates, but someone is looking for an assistant secretary of state or defense or treasury or whatever department. There'll be certain names that will come up on when they're being discussed. If there's an undersecretary designed by a department 2 weeks later or 2 months later, then some of the same names will make them be discussed. So a lot of it's luck. You might be considered for an assistant secretary one day, or under secretary another day, or commissioner another day. All depends, I think, on what background they're seeking, and you can be considered for different posts.
Hmm. That's interesting. How would you characterize your responsibilities as Undersecretary and then Deputy Secretary of State.
Well, in essence, you run the day-to-day State Department and handle anything that comes up to the Secretary isn't handling or doesn't want to handle or wants you to handle, both substantive and administrative.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a deputy that works closely with you or your own special assistant?
Well, I had a special assistant, very able for him, named Nick Veliotis, who later went on and retired from the service as a distinguished ambassador in Italy, and then also assistant secretary of state for Middle Eastern Affairs. Assistant, he was ambassador to Egypt as his last post. Hmm. He was deputy chief of mission in Israel, he was ambassador in Jordan, so he saw the Israeli Arab problem on both sides. Well, distinguished Foreign Service officer, and I was very fortunate to have him in his younger days. And he was a very able, energetic, intelligent young man. But then you also, of course, have Undersecretary for Political Affairs, which is Undersecretary Johnson. You had Nat Samuels, who's Deputy Undersecretary for Economic Affairs. You had all your assistant secretaries. Ed Elliott, of whom you spoke earlier, was the secretary of the, he headed the secretary of the department in that time. Counselor, so there are a lot of people on which you can rely, and on whom you can rely, and with whom you work.
How close did you work with Secretary Rogers?
Well, quite close. We met almost daily.
The meeting of all the undersecretaries, basically, and that's it.
No, he would start out often each day with a, usually Mr. Elliott, who knew what everything was going on procedurally. Perhaps the undersecretary for political affairs. The then undersecretary, deputy undersecretary for economic affairs, myself.
Mm-hmm.
That type of combination, 2 to 4 or 5 people most. Then once a week or so, he might have all of the assistant secretaries, maybe any other. But I think that became less of a, and you get so many people, you have so many diverse interests. Tends to be a little more.
Can you get a sense of how did the foreign policy making process under the Nixon administration compare to what that used by Eisenhower? How can you?
180 degrees different.
Yeah.
President Eisenhower really used the staff system in the NSC. The NSC was made to coordinate and discuss policy and not decide policy. And it had some very good national security assistants. Bobby Cutler ran it for a while, and then Gordon Gray ran it for a while, and both were able men. And Gordon Gray had been Assistant Secretary of the Army. But I never would have thought of either one of them trying to compete with the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense. The fact that they hesitated to speak up to what they thought, but they would coordinate and present a coordination view rather than trying to make it their own specific opinion. Under President Nixon, there was some of that, but the real top policy was President Nixon's policy, but added to and carried out.
I just wanted to remind you.
Holy smoke.
Added to and carried out. By
Dr. Kissinger. So really more of the policy was Dr. Kissinger working under and with President Nixon. Now, to some degree, obviously, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and others would participate. But in essence, it was really the President's policy effectively carried out by Dr. Kissinger.